but I passed the breath test. This is McDaniel Reynolds with the Reynolds Defense Firm, and we specialize in one thing. We represent good people facing DUI charges. While you know that it's illegal to drive with a .08 or greater blood alcohol content, not everyone knows that you could be arrested in Oregon for an alcohol DUI even if you blow well under a .08. This is a pretty loose standard, and it's a way that many of the good people we represent find themselves needing our help when they thought they were doing everything right. The Reynolds Defense Firm. We're solid, we're here if you need us, and we are very good at what we do.
BFFT. From the PAC West Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the bald-faced truth.
Final Four coming up this weekend. Women's Final Four starts tomorrow. Men's Final Four over the weekend into Monday. Basketball season will plateau. Tom Crean, former coach at Georgia, Indiana, Marquette, took Marquette to the 2003 NCAA Final Four. I covered that tournament. It's fantastic to see the Marquette fans showing up. It's part of the beauty of March Madness. You get to know some teams, programs, coaches that you may not have seen before. Tom Crean's been there. What is it like to be at a Final Four? How do you prepare your team? Is there an advantage for UConn, given that some of these players and coaches obviously were there a year ago? Tom Crean joining us to talk about the Final Four. How you doing, Coach?
I'm good, John. Good to be with you.
Will you be on site in Arizona for the Final Four, or where? How are you covering it?
No, I don't have any responsibilities with ESPN. One, actually not there. This is actually going to be a weekend that I have an 18-year-old daughter, and we got to make a couple final looks at for her college choices. So unless something changes drastically, I'll be traveling with her and looking forward to that. I got to do a lot of it in the summer with her, and haven't had a chance to do it lately. So we'll get a chance to do that. My wife, Joni, my daughter, and myself will get to do that this weekend.
Oh, that's very cool. I love that. And, I want to circle back to that because I went through that a couple years ago, and I know some of our listeners are probably thinking about colleges for their kids as well. I'd love to see, you know, kind of what your mindset is as you approach that. But let's start with the Final Four. You've been on that stage. Give us an idea of what these teams and these coaching staffs are going through right now as this tournament starts to get real.
Well, I think the fact that it's in Glendale helps some. When I was there, we were in New Orleans, and we were right downtown near Bourbon Street. We were right in the heart of the French Quarter, and I think that's cool. That's great, but so is everybody else down there. And the bottom line is our team handled it really well, I think. From everything I've gathered, they handled it really well, but there's so much attention being paid to it, and I think the fact now that it's out a little bit, you can travel. I think the thing the NCAA did a few years back, which has just been so big, is they allow the teams the opportunity to practice in there on Thursday. And it's closed. I don't know if the broadcasters get to be in or not, but it's closed. You do some media, but you get that feel on the court. Because when you go in there on Friday, that's really your time, but that's open to the public. And that is more of a spectacle. That's something like, that's a moment, that's a bucket list moment for everybody when you're in there. So when you get a chance to go in there and work, I think that really is beneficial. I think there's two ways to look at it. Like UConn going in late last night to be in there for today, staying at home a little bit longer because they've been there, done that, they understand it, is smart. But at the same time, I saw Alabama practiced at Grand Canyon yesterday. That's smart too. I mean, so there's really not a bad way to do it as long as your team can do everything that they can do to stay in character, to stay focused, to not get overly distracted with, you're going to get distracted with all the hype, but you can't get distracted into thinking that you've got to play a different way or that you've got to coach a different way. And the lights are never brighter. And the one thing you cannot have is stage fright, which puts you into a point where you don't play as relaxed as you need to be. Or you play so tight because you're trying to prove, if you're at the Final Four, you've already proven that you can really play. And the bottom line is to go out there and play that way. And I think that's really, really key, because what happens is you get tight and you start short arming shots and you start missing short, and all of a sudden that fast break happens. And a little bit of that's what happened to us in 2003. We missed a ton of really close 2 foot, 3 foot, 1 foot shots, which allowed Kansas to get out on that break. We thought we were fast and we thought we'd seen speed, but we had not seen that speed that Kansas had brought. So you got to make shots so you can set your defense. There's a lot of things that go into that, but you just want to stay in character as best you possibly can.
Stay in character. I love that. When you're approaching it from a coaching standpoint, there's an abundance of film. You can see anything you want to see, and maybe there's too much out there. How much is enough, coach, where, you know, you want to be prepared, but you don't want to overdo it?
Well, I think it's three-pronged. It really is. There's film, and there's two parts of that. There's the part where you're showing edits of what you want them to grasp, and part of those edits are the personnel tapes of the individual players, but you also want them to see flow. And that flow is not only the other team, but you want your team to see your flow. You want to remind your team what you do well, but you also want to remind your team of what you can't do in this game. And then I think there's the walkthrough in the ballrooms, in the hotels. I think those are incredibly important. And you're moving, you know, you can be in your gym shoes or not. I don't know if that's important. What's important is you're talking. You're talking the game. And I think the more you get your team talking the game, talking the coverages, talking out loud, and I don't mean whispering and mumbling, but I mean game voice, like really, really talking it is really important. And then you have your court action. And I think it's important that you get on the court and that you break a sweat, that you go through some things. It doesn't have to be overly live, but it's not all walkthrough, because you want your team comfortable in that environment. And it's as much important to go through that in a good way in the arena as it is whatever practice gym you use. I think that is crucial, that you get into that environment where you feel very, very comfortable in the court that you're going to play on.
UConn looks fantastic. And I think a lot of credit to that coaching staff and the program and the culture they've built there. But what do you see on the court? What are they doing to other teams right now?
They pass the ball as good as anyone, probably as good as anyone in the country. And the other thing they do is they've got Donovan Clingan, and they've got a tremendous backup in Samson Johnson's. They can play through Clingan, but more importantly than what they can do with him offensively, he just changes the entire game when he's on the court defensively. And he can block shots. He can alter shots. But most importantly, he's in the way of the rim. So, like, when you think you have an open layup, and this is going to be huge against Alabama, because Alabama shoots threes really well. Well, the reason they shoot threes so well is because they get layups. And they had 16 threes the other day, but their layup game is really, really strong. It's really important. And so those are going to be few and far between in a half-court situation. Like, they've really got to run in this game if they're going to be successful, because the rim is going to be covered. And then with the passing, the movement is constant. And Donovan Clingan has improved so much that he can post up, he can get behind the defense, they can play pick and roll. But what they are as well is they are a great screening team. And when I say sometimes the screens are real screens, but sometimes the screens look like they're screens and they're slips, and you think it's going to be a screen, like there's no wasted motion. So they have a really good game of deception as well. But I think the fact that they've improved as much as they have throughout the year, that guys like Stephon Castle has improved the way that he has, I think that's incredibly good. And at the end of the day, with all that being said, when things start to break down, they've got Cam Spencer and Alex Caravan that can cover up for a lot of mistakes on the perimeter, and then they've got Donovan Clingan inside that can cover up for mistakes at the rim.
If Alabama's going to have a chance in this game, and you know they're there, they're a team playing in this tournament, I would have to think that it starts for them on the defensive end of the court, because they're going to have to get in transition.
Oh, absolutely. And again, what they have an edge in this game is they've got to play through Grant Nelson as much as they can on the perimeter. Because the one thing Alabama has not done all year, it's one of the reasons that they've lost the games that they did, they can't really guard the rim. I mean, they're very, very analytically, they're poor in rim pressure, you know, with the numbers. But the look test also says they're poor with rim pressure. And they do they don't do a great job of taking away your duckings. They're extremely athletic. And I'm not, I mean, they're extremely well coached and they've got great guards and their bigs are agile and athletic. It's not that, but they're just not good at taking away post-ups, duck-ins, rolls, and they're really not good at taking away the rim. And Grant Nelson's coming off his best game, but at the same time, he's not going to be able to deal with Klingon. They've got to pull Klingon out as much as possible, because the one thing UConn will do is they will go up at times and go after that pick and roll. And you're not going to be able to beat them off the ball screen in the pick and roll game if they bring Klingon up. You've got to be able to kick the ball to the next pass, to the next outlet, and then he's got to try to get the ball to the rim either on a pass or on a drive before Klingon gets back into the paint. So that'll be a bit of a matchup for everybody to watch, how UConn guards Grant Nelson, because he's going to have to make, if they have any chance to beat UConn in that game, he's going to have to make at least 3 to 4 threes, in my mind.
Tom Crean with us, took Marquette to the Final Four, former Indiana coach as well. On the other side of the bracket, you've got Zach Edey and Purdue, and you have a North Carolina State team that just doesn't want the season to end. They just keep winning and winning. Let's start with NC State. When a team like that gets hot, gets on a roll, what is going right for them?
Improvement of their role players. DJ Burns has been able to score for a while. You can go back to last year, and he can score. He's really, really smart. He's great on his feet. He's got excellent touch to go with those hands. He's got really, really wide shoulders. I get all that he could be a football player talk. You know, he's got that. And he's almost impossible to block his shot because of where he releases the ball from, because he hits you right square in your chest, right in the sternum. And so he's really good. And then the other thing, because of that quickness, he can spin off of you. Like, if you try to guard him with one leg, like if you're going to try to position yourself on him and you're going to try to, you know, put one knee into his backside, split him a little bit like that, he's killing that. I mean, he's killing that. He killed Carolina on that. He did the same thing to Duke. That's no issue for him. He can do that. But the reason they've improved is Diarra and Michael O'Connell. Diarra is covering up so much ground. He's playing off DJ Burns as well as he ever has. They throw in Danny Cannell's nephew, Ben Middlebrooks, who can defend. He's tough. He'll rebound. So they've got they've got that third big that you need. But Michael O'Connell, who was a three-year grad from Stanford and went there in the portal, was one of the great portal pickups of the year. And I thought that when they got him. And he's been good this year, been inside of this tournament, and going back to the ACC tournament, he's been great. I mean, he's playing like he's a four-year leader, like he's been there the whole time. And I think that Braden Smith matchup with Michael O'Connell is a wash. I think they're both really good. I think they're both keys to their team. And I think that's a big reason that NC State has won. But what they have, with all that being said, what they have that Purdue doesn't have is they've got DJ Horn, who I think will be a real problem for either Fletcher Lawyer or Lance Jones trying to keep off the dribble. And I think that's one of the edges that North Carolina State has in this game. And obviously, Purdue's got their edges too. But I think the DJ Horn edge is a big one.
Coaches will always talk about wanting to get their teams playing well at the right time, but North Carolina State has played with its back against the wall. I think it's 8 or 9 games now. They faced elimination and they just keep winning. What is that worth in an event like this, where you've got a team that, you know, has played almost as a wild card all the way through the tournament?
Oh, I think it's valuable. I think the confidence is incredibly valuable. I think they're not going to get rattled. I think the key in a game like Purdue is you better not start whining about the officiating, the 3 seconds, or Zach having his elbows in your face, because he can't help it. He's 7'4", right? I mean, those elbows are going to be up. Now, he knows how to use them, don't get me wrong, and Matt's a great teacher. But like, Zach Edey's elbows, he's a 7'4 guy, so, like, deal with it. And the other thing is going to be, I think, the advantage that they have with the confidence of being through it, that, like, if you think you're going to play drop coverage like Gonzaga did and like some other people did against Purdue, and you think you're going to be able to do that and not keep a body on Edey or not swipe at him when he's got the ball in the post or not try to get into his legs every chance that you get, you're not winning. Zach Edey is too smart. He's not only too good, he's too smart. And he's seen every coverage possible. It's the people that make it hard for him to get loose because they kept a body on him, or when they see the eyes go down, when he's into his move, they're going down there to try to attack the dribble. The people that think they're going to rotate and, you know, we're just going to get big and we're going to come to him once he gets in the paint, he chews that up. And then if you make him kick it out, he reposts or he gets in position to offensive rebound. So if you got to look at the coverage and say, we can't let Zach Edey be free. Like, he's got to feel somebody. And the more we can get two people for him to feel, the better. But we better do a great job of making sure that his body is not loose, because he's so big, he's so strong, and he's so good at creating his leverage that if you let him get a head start because you came into his body late, he's just going to carve that up.
Yeah, we have seen players at this juncture of the NCAA tournament who shine. And Dwayne Wade was one of those guys for you that everybody could see it. Like, you knew it all along, but suddenly everybody could see it. Is there a player in this foursome here that you're looking at going, there's going to be, this is a coming out party, or are we already talking about it, Zach Edey and some others?
Oh, I think we are. I don't know if there's anybody that's going to be a surprise. I think the key is going to be, can the guys that have been playing well in the tournament keep that up? That's where DR and O'Connell come in. That's where, here's a name, Mason Gillis at Purdue, because you got to guard him. I mean, he's a three-point shooter. He had a game last year, I believe it was against Indiana, that he had, or it was either, I think it was Indiana or Ohio State, I don't remember exactly, but he made like 8 threes in a game. And he's a guy that when he was projected really young, he was going to be a first-round draft pick in baseball. And he decided to focus on basketball, and he's become an outstanding role player for Purdue. He's the kind of guy that you look at the end of the night, and he got 15 points, and all of a sudden America didn't really realize how good he is. Or I think for UConn, I think people know Alex Caravan is good, but I don't know if they know how good he is. And I don't think anybody should be shocked on Saturday or Monday night if they're in it, and all of a sudden the game is over, and Alex Caravan had 18 to 21 points with 5 assists. And he guarded, and he was a mainstay defensively. It's guys like that that can make a difference. I think NC State's full of those guys. For Alabama, I would say this guy has got to be really, really good if they're going to win on Saturday and have a chance to play and win on Monday, is Rylan Griffin. Aaron Estrada's a veteran. Mark Sears is really, really good. Grant Nelson, we said he's got to make some shots. Rylan Griffin's coming off a great game the other day against Clemson. He's got to be really, really good as a sophomore, because he's their best perimeter defender, and he's probably their second-best shooter behind Mark Sears.
Tom Crane with us. You can catch him on ESPN as an analyst, also on radio, and obviously coached at a high level with Georgia and Indiana and Marquette, among other stops. Coach, I saw when the game officials were announced for the Final Four, I kind of casually glanced at it, but I'm sure the coaches and both staffs and all the staffs were kind of poring over it. How much does the officials and the officiating assignments matter in a Final Four?
Oh, it matters every night. So it definitely matters in a Final Four, because the trick is this, like, if you probably don't want, if you're the opposing coach, you probably don't want Big Ten officials doing the Purdue game, because they become so used to how Zach Edey plays. And I have no problem with how he plays. I mean, maybe I would if I was in the league. But the bottom line is, he's 7'4". He's really, really hard to officiate. And I think with me, even during the regular season, I would go back. I would get the statistics, go back through the box scores. There were ways to do this. And I would watch the last 5, 6 games that an official had done the games, because you wanted to get a feel. I didn't do it every night, but I did it a lot of nights, especially in conference. Because you wanted to see, because they all do so many different leagues, right? So, like, the Big Ten, and anybody can say what they want, that officiating's the same every time. No, it's not. The Big 12 is different. The Pac-12 is different. Ask all these people in the Pac-12, like Eric Musselman now and Dana Altman and Danny, well, Danny Sprinkle would be different. But Dana Altman, ask them how different in a year the Big Ten officiating is going to be than it is in the Pac-12. It's just going to be. And so it just, there's no doubt about it. So you want to get a feel for what are the go-to calls of people? Who gets the advantage offensively or defensively? Who do you want to see refereeing at the basket? When somebody's underneath the rim or somebody's the side official that's looking at post play, what are they more apt to call? And we would chart that stuff. We would look at it. I would never really complain about who was calling what. I would just make sure that we had a pretty good scouting report on who would call what, right, based on the game, and not get into guys about, well, you haven't called this, you haven't called that. But we'd almost scout the officials the way that we did the other team. And I think if you're not doing that in a Final Four situation, you're not giving your team every chance to win. And anybody that says that's too much, well, you know what? We got a lot of data right now that you can study and look at. And there's nothing wrong with looking at that either. Because they're human beings too, right? And they've advanced to this place to be in the Final Four and to be in the national championship game. What are their pet calls? What are they like? What are they like in the post? What are they like up front, up top? And the rest of it, you know, how do they deal with off-ball contact? You know, those are the things. Everybody's, well, it's block charge. No, that's pretty simple in this day and age. They've kind of established how they're going to call that. But it's the other things that become personnel-driven based on the officials that you really need to look at.
I had somebody ask me the other day, they said, you know, we less frequently see 3 seconds of the key called these days. Is it because offenses now are different? Are we seeing more high pick and roll and we're the less of what, you know, Purdue is wanting to do with Zach Edey? Or what do you make of that?
I think that in traveling. Yeah, I think it's been going that way. I think there's so much going on in the paint that you're looking at who's getting advantage. Like the Big 12 is a great example. Everybody says, well, it's really physical. They let you beat each other up. No, I'm on the official side on this. They don't let you get a big advantage, right? Like, it's going to be really physical. And I've coached a lot of games, and I've watched a lot, especially this year, where you look at it and say, no, they're really, for the most part, if you try to take advantage of the advantage that you're being given, well, now they're going to blow the whistle on you. But they will let you go in there, and they will let you go at each other. So I think that becomes, I think there's way less visual studying. And I'm not an official, and I haven't really asked officials this, but I think they pay way less attention to feet than they do anything else. And I think that's why you get the 3 seconds, and I think that's why you get the travels. I think they get so caught up in making sure that they are calling what they want enforced. And I think it gets a little tighter in the NCAA tournament because you don't advance if you have too many screw-ups. But I think officiating has a really hard job. I always thought that when I was coaching, and I would complain, and I'd want to learn things, and I might get mad and all that. But I think they got a really hard job, man, because at some point they got to widen this lane for real. You know, not just an NIT as an experimental rule. We've been experimenting with it for 10 years now. At some point, people got to say, hey, we're going to make the game better. We're going to make it more free-flowing. Okay, let's make it a little bit easier and quit getting these figureheads in these rooms that think that really don't have boots on the ground, right? Because that's when all the mistakes get made, when you got people that think they know what it is, but you don't have boots on the ground that are in the room telling you what is really going on. And just open up the floor a little bit. I mean, if they can do it in Europe, and if they can do it in the pros, and they can do it in the ladies' game, I think, why can't we do it in the men's game? Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me.
Amen to that. Let's put you as commissioner of college basketball, and we'll get it changed.
No.
Who do you like?
I'd be considered one of those figureheads. I don't want any part of that.
Right. But, you know, there's nothing worse. Like, when I talk to football coaches, they talk about getting in those rules meetings, and they're looking around going, there's nobody who's coached football making a decision here. Like, we're in real trouble.
Hey, yeah, we can go back to what happened after the FBI scandal and go and look at some of those committees that were formed, and we shouldn't really be sitting here wondering why we're in the situation that we're in, right? I mean, it is what it is. But, I mean, you got to have people, and that's no knock on the people that were in the room. But at some point, you got to put people in the room that know how it's done. That you really do. I mean, it's a crazy world, and it's going to get. This is all going to get more crazy before it gets better. And, you know, until at some point, they're going to have to look at the contracts. They're going to have to look at caps inside of different leagues. I mean, the money is incredible. I mean, it's there's middle of the road Power Five point guards. They're going to get upwards of $500,000 in a car right now, at the very least, right now, because it's such a seller's market. And I know last time I was on your show, we talked about this, but it's like, it's absolutely crazy. There's no way that is sustainable. You know, it's one thing to have the money. It's another thing to be paying inordinate amounts of money for average players. But that's the market right now. And until they get, until they, and I have no trouble with people making money, but at some point, they've got to get some kind of constraints in here as to what each league has. And then if you're good enough to have an agent, if you're good enough to have, you know, a CAA or a Clutch or a WME or somebody like that representing you, and so great, good for you. I mean, that means you're a heck of a player. But at some point, they're going to have to get control of this because it's just going to get more nuts. And that's the same thing with the rules. Put people in there that understand the game, that are in the middle of it, and get something done.
Who do you like to play in the championship game on Monday night?
I like UConn and Purdue. I think the thing with if NC State was really good at pick and roll basketball with DJ Burns, I might feel different. But they're so much of a post up team. I think DJ Burns will be an issue. I think it's going to be a really close game between Purdue and NC State. It really could go either way in my mind, but I think it'll be Purdue, and I think it'll be Purdue and UConn on Monday night. And I just don't know if anybody's got enough over a 40-minute game. I mean, look at UConn this past Saturday. They were shooting the ball so poorly, but at the end of the day, Illinois went on a 30-0 run, and they still, their perimeter shooting at times was atrocious. Like, you would look at some of UConn's shooting and say there's no way they can win. But yet they wouldn't let the other team score. And Illinois is one of the fastest, most explosive, well-rounded offensive teams in the country. And they had those moments. UConn's just that good. Now, I take all that back. If Donovan Klingon, if something goes wrong where he is can't play in the game, because he changes the game more than any. Zach Edey changes the game offensively big time. Donovan Klingon changes the game so much more, maybe, than anybody right now defensively.
You're going to tour some colleges. You're going to be a dad while this is all going on. What are you excited about that? Because I know, you know, as a coach, you got to mentor and be a father figure for a lot of kids, but you really are a father figure for your kid.
Yeah, our two oldest went to the schools where we lived, where we were coaching, at Indiana and Georgia. So it was always a little bit different. But, yeah, I've enjoyed this part of it. My wife has made a couple trips. I made most of them in the summer. But it's getting to that point now. And so I think it's like anything else. You choose a college, but you're not just choosing it. You're not just looking at the dorms and where they're going to eat. You know, obviously that's big for the kids, but you want to get a feel when you're on these campuses. And I think one of the great things, like if I went back to coaching, one of the first things that I would do is I would get myself and my staff and anybody that was going to be on the program, we would go take one of those student-led tours. And we might do it a couple times, because you get around those students, and especially when they get off script a little bit and they start walking around and you start asking them questions, that's when you get a real feel for what the school is about. And I think it's you just get a vibe for it. You get a feel. It's like anything else. It's like you want people to have when coming to your program, right? Like somebody comes in and watches you practice, they should know within 20, 30 minutes if they want to be there or not. And I think to me, it's the same thing when you get on a campus. How does it feel? What's it like? How are the people? And you can't make a total judgment call, but you can base it a little bit on how you feel. And then the academic part of it kicks in there, and obviously you want that respect level for your child academically, but more importantly, you want them to be happy, you want them to be comfortable, and you want them looking forward to being in that school every day. And I think it's important to watch how your kid reacts in it.
Tom Crean, you're the best. Have a great weekend, and we'll get you back on. Love to see you coaching again.
Oh, I'll get there. I'll get there. I just got to get the right one. So I appreciate it very much, John. Anytime.
Anytime. I love it. All right, Tom Crean, there he goes. Great stuff on the Final Four, coaching, parenting. Love the stuff on officiating. Anna's coming into the studio next. What happened to the Pointer Sisters? What happened to REM? What happened? Like, you know, what happened? What happened to all these 80s and 90s bands who disappeared? She's not going to have the answers, but I'm still wondering.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
This show has a lot of purposes, okay? One of the purposes is I'm here to talk some sports. We're also here to make your, our aim is to make your life, your afternoon, your day more enjoyable than it was. We also are here to, definitely here to inform you, and we're here to train you as parents, like on yesterday's show when we said, hey, get your kids, you're doing too much for your kids. All you moms out there that are pandering, helicoptering around your kids, dads who are out there planning craft activities, knock it off. Let these kids just be. Let them figure it out themselves. It's okay for them to be bored. It's okay for them to be disappointed. That's okay. That, in fact, would benefit them. Now, Anna, on today's show, I have another topic I want to get into.
No, I can't wait.
I want to know what happened. You know, we do a where are they now when it comes to athletes.
Yeah.
We'll be like, Dale Murphy, where are they now? Well, Dale Murphy is running several successful companies out of, born in Portland, Oregon. He's involved with the Portland Diamond Project. He's got kids who are playing college football. We do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
What happened to, like, Digital Underground?
Rappers in the top 10, please allow me to bump thee. I'm stepping tall, y'all, and just like Humpty Dumpty, you're gonna fall when the stereos pump me. I like to rhyme. What happened to that guy,
Shock G? You know? What happened to Humpty? What happened to R.E.M.? What happened to the Pointer Sisters? Why are we not, like, you know, like the Backstreet Boys?
We know what happened to them.
They came back.
Yeah.
And they did a tour.
Yeah.
Turns out Shock
Streaks back again.
The rapper who sings that song,
yeah,
Humpty.
Yeah.
He died of a drug overdose.
Mm.
So that answers that one.
Okay.
Pointer Sisters.
Okay.
Do you remember the Pointer Sisters?
Mm-hmm.
They were a big deal.
They were.
Like in the 1980s?
Yeah.
The Pointer Sisters had it going on. And yet... I thought, gosh, you know, we hear about some of these bands that will continue to tour and do whatever, but, you know, we don't hear anything about the Pointer Sisters. And then I Googled the Pointer Sisters. Why are you laughing? You're making fun of me.
No.
I'm asking serious questions
over here. I'm actually really glad that these random conversations that occur in the course of the day, like, we might have just one or two interactions in the course of the day before we arrive at this point where I'm on radio with you. And so there's a deep sense of satisfaction that I get that everyone now listening understands, like, these are the types of conversations that occur between you and I before this moment.
The Pointer Sisters should be on, like, tour.
Yeah.
Doing a reunion, and it turns out two of them passed away.
Right.
And the other one's not doing well either.
Okay.
So that one
explains
itself.
Yeah.
Is there a band that, you know, maybe you're wondering? The other one that I thought about is, what about, like, and this is not a band that I liked.
Okay.
But I always found them kind of oddly weird, like, kind of strange.
Okay.
Eurythmics. Annie Lennox, Dave Stewart.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I'll play a little bit of that for people who don't know. See if you can ring a bell.
Thank you.
what's not to like about that, really?
You know,
solid lyrics.
They broke up once.
Uh-huh.
So they broke up in like 1990.
Okay.
Then they got back together again 9 years later.
Oh.
And then they broke up again after they just came out and had a hit.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, they're kind of like these people that maybe they've been married, they get divorced, they get married again.
I know, you hear about that.
Have you seen those couples?
I've seen those couples.
What do those friends do? What do friends of couples who divorce and then get married for a second time?
Yeah.
Because you kind of have to pick sides.
You do have to pick sides a lot of the time. So you hope that you didn't say anything too nasty about the ex while they were apart. So
good reminder.
You can make amends once they get back together. You just never know these days, right?
That's like when you have a friend. I had a friend in college. He had a kind of a tumultuous relationship with his girlfriend.
Uh-huh.
And they would break up like every Friday.
Right.
Get back together on Sundays.
As people do.
Yeah. And so they would break up on the Friday, and you'd be like, oh, yeah, so happy you got rid of her. I really don't like who you are when you're with her.
Uh-huh.
Like, you didn't look like you were enjoying your life.
Right.
You're too young for this.
Yeah.
And then you walk in on Sunday, and she's sitting on the sofa.
Right.
And you're like, okay, this is awkward.
That happens. Well, they got freed up for Saturday night. You know, that's really what happened. They freed up both of their social calendars.
Oh, was it a strategy?
Saturday night.
Somebody was strategizing.
Just opening a little window, and then it closes on Sunday when things get serious for the rest of the week.
Okay, here's one more bad. This is my final one. I promise this is the last one I'm going to do here. But, like, as I was throwing this out there, I had people texting me saying, you know, what happened to Counting Crows?
Yeah.
What happened to R.E.M.?
Yeah.
And that got me thinking, like, I was not a fan of R.E.M. to begin with.
No, yeah.
Not my thing, but...
Not your cup of tea.
But I get it. What happened to them? I think what we're onto an idea here. I think what we should do is go out and get all these bands from the 80s and 90s that people are going, whatever happened to?
And
get them all back together and do like a charity concert.
You think so?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah.
Do we want to see these old grandpas rocking?
There it is. There it is.
Well,
yeah. I mean, a lot of them still tour. You know, a lot of them still have it. Look at Madonna. She's out there shaking it. Like, no one knows how old she actually is, but she's out there. She's a grandma, and she's on stage holding it together, except for the part where she fell on stage. Wasn't really her fault. It was up in Seattle.
I think we get it. We get all these bands together.
Yeah.
We get what's left of Digital Underground.
But see, remember, I dragged you to that thing a few years ago. It came through town. It was called the Boo Bomb, and it was a lot of these people that you're mentioning. It was Salt-N-Pepa. It was Tone Loc.
I didn't mention Salt-N-Pepa or Tone Loc, but I know what you're saying.
Yeah. And it was...
Let's do it.
Yeah, yeah. And what I concluded, I don't know what you got out of that, but what I concluded was that I wanted these people to just remain in my memory, not so much in the present.
I was going to suggest that we get them all together and we take them out. Our friend Derek, who owns and operates Oswego Hills Vineyard.
Yeah.
Yeah. We are going to hold a big concert out at the vineyard. I haven't shared this with him yet.
Right. No, but that's why.
But
that
maybe
necessary?
What we do is we say, hey, we were going to hold a concert, but instead we think that the 80s and 90s are best left where they were. Just come out and have some wine instead.
you
know what I mean?
So a bait and switch.
Bait and switch.
Yeah.
Play some Leapfrog on the lawn.
Yeah.
You know, enjoy a glass of Pinot. And, you know, reminisce about Humpty and Tone Loc and Salt-N-Pepa.
Did you say reminisce?
I did.
Reminisce. Are you going to
slip.
Are you going to reminisce some espresso in your mouth?
I do it all the time. I do it all the time. I have my own dialect. Okay. But here's the thing. I do it, and then I just go right through it.
Yeah, I know.
I don't stop and go, excuse me.
Right.
But you're here
to
call attention to it. I reminisced about it. but we could have all of these bands.
Yeah.
Okay. But we would just say, "Eh, we're going to leave it as is." Maybe they play the music. Just
maybe,
play it.
No, but see, the hook is we bring in a cover band that performs the same songs, but at a higher quality level.
Don't you have a friend, John Michael, who played in the Guns N' Roses cover band, where he actually dressed up like Slash or Axl, or he was one of the characters.
Yeah, he was great. The Appetite for Deception. Yeah.
I love that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they were awesome.
They were good because I actually think in some weird way, they think they are Guns N' Roses. Like, I think there's a little bit of character. Like, you know how some people, like, Daniel Day-Lewis will take on a role.
Right. And he doesn't come out of it.
That people on the set know when he is Lincoln.
Yeah.
They call him Mr. President on the set. Like, Steven Spielberg, as he's directing Lincoln, is talking to Daniel Day-Lewis, and he's saying, "Mr. President, we'd like for you to try that take again."
Yeah.
He's in character.
He doesn't break character.
So your buddy, John Michael, who plays in Appetite for Deception.
Yes.
Nice name for a band.
Yeah.
I think he actually thinks like they are doing everything the band did back in the day.
If you're going to be true to form, then you have to kind of channel that energy, right?
They're like hooking up with groupies. They're like
I don't know about
doing
that.
Heavy He's hardcore happily activities.
Married.
No,
happily married. Well, maybe not that part.
Not that part.
Yeah.
All right, good stuff. But I think I'm onto something.
You're onto something.
If a promoter out there, like, I don't need to be the promoter.
Yeah.
If a promoter out there thinks this is a good idea, just give me a fist bump and throw a free ticket my way.
Yeah.
But,
or you can just tune in and watch VH1 Behind the Music. You know?
I know.
You can do that or just turn into VH1. Is that still a channel?
I know my buddy Derek at Oswego Hills Vineyard is going to be like, "Dude, you cannot hold a concert at my vineyard," but I still think
knows?
It's a great idea.
Maybe he'll be all over
it. I think
it.
It's a great idea.
Yeah.
All right, leave it here. You got the BFT.
You've got the home of the truth. Back to the bald-faced truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, I went off on the Trailblazers earlier, talked about them giving away lip balm as part of their Fan Appreciation Day. Really, you've made it when your franchise gives away lip balm. Can't wait to get some lip balm for the Fan Appreciation Day. The Marlins have something that's interesting in Major League Baseball. Is this better than lip balm? You be the judge. Miami Marlins have started a all-you-can-eat, basically it's all-you-can-eat seats. For $52, all-you-can-eat, a fan documented his experience by posting video of himself eating a hamburger and a chili dog in the first inning. Game went on. He ate everything from nachos, cookies, peanuts, popcorn, got through every item on the menu. Not surprisingly, he did stop at the restroom. And basically, all-you-can-eat tickets allow fans to grab and go their items, so he had no lines. And by the way, they cut it off after the seventh inning. And there are 8 different food items plus soda and water to drink. This is better than lip balm. Is it kind of grossing you out, though, to see all the photos of what this guy ate at the game? He ate everything. Hot dogs, chili dogs, nachos with cheese, chili nachos, cheeseburger, popcorn, peanuts, cookies, soda, water.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, the best part about that, it's like, you know, it's grab and go. So you don't even have to line up for this. You can just grab it and take it back to your seat.
They limit you to 4 items per visit. So let me just throw this at you. Here's the menu. Hot dog, chili dog, nachos with cheese, chili nachos, cheeseburger, popcorn, peanuts, cookies, soda, water. Those are the items available.
Yeah.
You can only grab 4 at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Steven, Anna, it's the first inning.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't had anything to eat.
Yeah.
What are you grabbing first?
Oh, I have to start with a hot dog and a chili dog. Steven?
I'm going nacho first. Nacho is my favorite. I love a nacho. Like with cheese
like an
sauce.
Appetizer.
It doesn't matter.
Main course.
Doesn't
Are you doing
matter.
Nachos with cheese or the chili nachos?
Just nacho with cheese. We'll save the chili for later. But I'm definitely getting a some candy. That way I can like put it in my pocket just in case I don't eat it. I can take it home. Some water.
Yeah. Candy wasn't on the list.
Yeah, there's cookies, soda, water.
Oh, cookies.
Cookies.
He's going to get candy. Cookies. Sorry.
It's popcorn, peanuts, soda, cookies, and water. Anna, you're just grabbing a hot dog and a chili dog. Nothing to drink.
No. Oh, well, yeah. And then a soda to start.
You're going with soda.
Yeah. You got to wash that down with a soda.
I'm going hot dog.
Yeah. What are you doing?
And then I'm probably going to go off menu. I'm going to grab a beer. I'm going to grab a beer and a dog.
that's going to be more than their $52 ticket.
But I need to have, ever since James Earl Jones said, to Kevin Costner, what do you want, Ray? And Ray said to James Earl Jones, what do you want? And he said, I want people to think for themselves. I want people to leave me alone. And then Ray said, no, what do you want? And he pointed at the concession stand.
Yeah.
James Earl Jones goes, dog and a beer. That's ever since then. I go to a game, dog and a beer. It's got to be. It's in my head.
So you would get a hot dog or a chili dog?
I get a hot dog.
And a beer.
And I go get a beer. I'll go stand in line and get a beer.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I come back, I'm going through the line like that guy was.
Me too.
I got to have popcorn. Yeah. I got to have a soda. I got to get the chili nachos and the nachos side by side. Yeah. See which one's better. Pretty good idea. Better than lip balm.
You know, service ends at the end of the seventh inning. They cut that off.
So you have 7 innings.
You have 7 innings.
It's like a little league game to consume this. Anna's got the 5 at 5 coming up. Leave it here.
BFFT. From the PacWest Center in downtown Portland, presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with a bald-faced truth.
Want to give a shout-out to the Hillsboro Hops. They are opening their opening weekend tomorrow night. 3-game series, Friday, Saturday, Sunday in Hillsboro. It'll be Everett in town. Hillsboro Hops, strong supporters of the BFT Foundation, and a pretty cool family event. Good luck to them this season. Anna is still here. You're still here. You left. You came back during the commercial break.
It's what I do. I like to keep you on your toes.
I made the mistake of saying that the show doesn't really start till Anna gets here. She's never going to forget that I said that.
Gonna be hard to fit my head through a door.
Are you ready to do the 5 at 5?
Of course.
Are you all?
Let's do it.
Jazzed
Come on,
up.
Let's go. We don't need a bunch of lead up. Let's
all right,
just
here
do
we
it.
Go. There it is. The 5 at 5.
The 5 at 5. Number 1.
Is this an issue? People were tweeting at us about this. The UConn men's team landed at 6:20 in the morning for the Final Four. They had a bunch of plane issues, mechanical issues with the original aircraft, which was set to depart on Wednesday. It was unable to fly. They had to like trim the travel party. It was going to be a flight time decision as far as refueling and the overall weight of the plane. Alabama and Purdue had already arrived on Tuesday. NC State got to Phoenix on Wednesday. Does this ultimately matter with the Huskies not playing until Saturday night?
It could matter, but, they landed in Phoenix. It was early this morning. Minor mechanical issue. I think most people say, hey, it's Thursday. They're not playing anyway till Saturday. Little bit of a rhythm issue. Some of the teams have been there now and have practiced a full day in front of it. So, Tom Crean, our expert earlier in the show, said it does it matter? Doesn't it matter? Like, you kind of figure that out later. You look back and go, did they look like they weren't locked in? Because the advantage being that North Carolina State, Purdue, UConn, Alabama are all in this event, but only 3 of the teams got to have a real practice today. Like, UConn probably would do a walkthrough or a light practice. I don't know what they would do after getting in so early, but, It's unfortunate, but they're there. I don't think this is going to be the thing that stops UConn if they don't win the tournament. They are, you know, everybody expects them to win the tournament. They are the favorites. They are a big favorite in this semifinal game on Saturday. Let's see how they play Saturday.
Number two.
Normally, this is not something that we would talk about, but I find that there's a lot of interest in this year. LSU's Haley Van Lith entered the portal today. Now, this is going to be her third school that she's seeking to play at. And for anybody that watched her trying to guard Caitlin Clark, we know that that didn't really go well for her. What I'm curious about is how much of this has to do with playing for Kim Mulkey, who recently a players poll showed she's not somebody the players are wild about playing
for. How many players did they poll?
There was 95, so it's a small sample.
Here's the thing. I went back and looked at their poll from a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
Kim Mulkey was second most favorite year ago. Now she's in last place. Look, I'll be the first to bag on Kim Mulkey, but I think it just happens to be like which five players trash a coach.
Okay.
You know what I mean? And here's the thing, though. Haley Van Lith, she had a great thing going at Louisville.
Yeah.
She was the centerpiece of what they were doing there. She transfers, the grass is greener, goes to LSU. Now, after a year, is going, it didn't work out for me. Like, I think sometimes players jump in the portal. There's now more than 1,100 Division I women's basketball players in the portal, by the way. I think sometimes players jump in the portal just because everybody else is jumping in the portal. It's like, hey, you know, I changed club teams twice. I'm going to change colleges, too. You have a good thing going like Haley Van Lith had at Louisville. Stay there and just shovel coal.
But do you think it's wise for her to try to transfer again?
If it's not working out, it's not working out, but
we all saw, like, she was shrugging her shoulders on the floor trying to guard Caitlin Clark.
She couldn't guard
Kim Mulkey is just eyes down in disgust. Her own coach. We all watched
it. I actually don't think, like, it was that big of an indictment of Haley Van Lith. I just think there's a lot of players who aren't Caitlin Clark. And when Caitlin Clark gets to the WNBA, what we will see is we are going to see more athletic, longer, better players who force Caitlin Clark to do, you know, different things on the court and force her to work harder for fewer shots. And I think, you know, we've seen this with a lot of players who go from college basketball to the WNBA. Cindy Brunson came on the show about a month ago, and she talked about, like, this growing pains of young players who go to the league, because all of a sudden, Caitlin Clark's not going to have Haley Van Lith guarding her. She's going to have Satu Sabally guarding her, who can move and who is big and physical. We've seen her at Oregon and is an all-star in the WNBA, largely because she can defend. And that's going to be harder for Caitlin Clark. But Haley Van Lith should have stayed at Louisville, where life was just fine. You good with that?
Yeah.
Number three.
Speaking of Caitlin Clark, Sabrina Ionescu shows up in the most interesting times and places, doesn't she? Like, Nike sure knows marketing. She surprised Iowa women's basketball team ahead of the Final Four with brand new pairs of her signature shoe, the Sabrina Ones. I'm more interested in what she had to say to the team after her arrival. Her message to the team was really cool. I think it's something we can all take from. She said, enjoy playing for one another. You're never going to get another room like this. There's never going to be another team that you guys are going to be on that's like this. Be proud of how you have represented yourself, your team, and what you've done for everyone, not just Iowa basketball. It's pretty cool.
And all I can think about when you're saying that is the fact that Oregon went to the Final Four in 2019, and Sabrina and Oregon were locked in 2020.
Yes.
They were going to go to New Orleans. They were going to win the national championship. nobody was beating the Oregon Ducks that year. I booked the tickets. I was sure of it. It was happening. Pandemic cancels the tournament. I know Oregon fans don't want to hear this, but Sabrina should have put a national championship in the rafters at Matthew Knight Arena. There should be a national championship banner. So when you say that she says you're never going to be on this stage, never going to have this moment, there's part of me that's going, gosh, she knows how, like, don't take it for granted, the fact that you have a Final Four to go to. It's a big deal.
Number four.
Well, Kirk Cousins, you know, he has spent the last 6 years playing with the Minnesota Vikings, but he's hoping to finish his NFL career with the Atlanta Falcons. He's, you know, saying that this is my Miami Heat, basically, like comparing himself to Shaquille playing for the Heat. He says, I want this to be my final stop. I don't want to go play for, you know, anybody else.
This is it. Why didn't you just say that?
Well, you know, because
it's kind of a weird, he's kind of a strange guy. And that's kind of a peculiar reference. Because it's kind of an old guy reference, you know.
Well, it's Kirk Cousins.
It's just my Miami Heat thing, and I immediately thought of LeBron, and we're taking our talents to South Beach. And yet he's talking about, no, before that, when Shaq went to Miami and said, this is it. Or how about just Michael Jackson, who said, this is it. Kirk, you know, you afraid to quote Michael Jackson? I don't know. I hope it works out for him.
Well, it's kind of cute. He's saying that his boys are 6 and 5. They won't remember that he played in Washington, and they'll barely remember that he played in Minnesota, but they will remember that he played for the Falcons.
And a lot of Minnesota fans and Washington fans will say we barely remember it, too.
Also, Shaq didn't finish his career in Miami.
Yeah.
He played for three different teams after that. So
that's right.
So Kirk is a little off on that one.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Well, you know, details.
Kind of sad that Michael Jackson didn't get to do that tour when he said, this is it.
Yeah.
You know?
I know.
And then he passed away before he got to do the tour.
Right.
Because we're talking about all those musical acts that, you know, I'm going, what happened to Digital Underground? What happened to REM? What happened to the Pointer Sisters? You know, we all know what happened to Michael Jackson. It wasn't a happy ending.
Number five.
Let's hope it ends better for
Kirk Cousins.
For Kirk Cousins. Maybe he'll, like, go deep in the playoffs. I don't know. Okay, I have to finish with this one because it's just so weird to me, and I need someone to explain to me what this means. The Oakland Athletics, they've been searching for a place to play. Salt Lake wanted them. But it turns out they will play in Sactown from 2025 to 2027 while their new stadium in Las Vegas is being built. They will play at Sutter Health Park in Sacramento.
Sacramento viewing this as an economic benefit to their community.
Yeah.
People talking about the housing prices in Sacramento rising. And I'm like, they think all the fans are moving there? The team's moving? The players are moving? Yeah, temporarily. This is a 3-year deal. It appears that the difference between what Oakland offered and what the A's wanted, because the Oakland was trying to keep them at the Coliseum, was about $10 million a year difference. So the A's said, we'll save the money and go to Sacramento. It just kind of shows you where John Fisher's head is. Like, you know, this is like, $10 million is not even a good relief pitcher. So they'll go to Sutter Health Park in West Sacramento, minor league ballpark, where the Sacramento Rivercats play. And they will play there from 2025 to 2027. And then the plan is to move to Las Vegas in 2028. I kind of wonder if the A's are auditioning in Sacramento. Because Sacramento has, for a long time, wanted Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. And they would love to have an expansion team. So is the idea, though, that the Rivercats AAA team and the A's is going to be kind of a dry run for Major League Baseball to see how do the A's draw in Sacramento? Mm. Do they draw 14,000 a night and fill that stadium? Or is it more of the same like in the Coliseum? But About $35 million difference over 3 years. A's are going, we're going to get out of Oakland sooner rather than later.
I'm really confused on where this organization is headed. I mean, I get it. They're going to be playing in Sacramento.
And then Vegas, maybe.
And then Vegas.
Probably.
Probably, maybe. But by then, will they have lost the fan base?
Of course.
Along the way? They already have.
They already have. This
so,
opening day was empty.
So, I mean, is this thing really even going to exist?
Yep. It is. It'll go to Vegas, and the hope will be that they'll get the renaissance that the Raiders got, but they're not going to do that. Baseball fans are not going to go to Vegas and say, hey, the Yankees are in town. I need to fly in and go to see Carrot Top and go see a Yankee game. No, I think it'll be better than it was in Oakland, but I'm not. I was in Vegas for like 10, 11 days covering the men's and women's Pac-12 tournaments. Everybody there that I talked to, I couldn't find anybody who was like, we can't wait for baseball.
Right.
There was nobody.
Right.
Like, nobody said that. Not an Uber driver.
But before the Golden Knights went there, did anyone was anyone saying, we can't wait for NHL?
They were dying for hockey.
Okay.
They were dying for hockey. They were dying for the NFL. They're dying for the NBA. Nobody is talking about baseball except the A's and some developers in Vegas. I'm not sure this is going to work.
Right. So, like, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is this whole thing going to flop?
The A's end up in Portland. That's what happens.
And are they thinking they play in Sacramento and that's close enough for fans to drive to?
I think what they're thinking is they're saving $30 million over 3 years, which is nothing to a Major League Baseball team. They're saving $30 million and going, we'll draw about the same or better that we did at the Coliseum, even though there's only 14,000 seats, because opening day, the photograph of the stadium on opening day looked like approximately how many people are in my living room at any given moment.
Yeah, they had like a food cart like area outside the stadium before opening day. Nobody was there. Like literally zero people.
You want to get a foul ball, you go to the Oakland A's games this season at the Coliseum. You know, talk about fan appreciation. They're not giving out lip balm, they're giving out foul balls.
You get your whole section.
I have no connection to the A's. I have no loyalty to them. But it's disturbing to me that, like, a professional sports organization could make such terrible decisions and run themselves into the ground.
It's almost like they did it on purpose, and it kind of makes me wonder. I'm going to be a little sinister here. This could be my last day on air.
Oh, today could be.
Yeah.
Because yesterday might have been, but it wasn't.
No.
Okay. Gather around, everyone.
Or we're talking about what the A's are doing to their fans.
Yeah.
Does it not at least rhyme with what Jody Allen is doing with the Blazers fans? I'm not saying it's the same thing, but it kind of rhymes as Malcolm Gladwell Mark Twain might say.
He was the one that said history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes.
Yeah. Remember when I had the documentary guy on? The famous documentary
guy?
Ken Burns was on. Remember when I had him on the show?
Yeah.
He quoted Mark Twain and said it rhymes.
Yeah.
History rhymes. He's poetic that way.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, doesn't Jody Allen giving away lip balm on fan appreciation night and fielding a terrible roster and turning off the fans, isn't this everything John Fisher did in Oakland? Isn't it everything Clay Bennett did with the Sonics? I'm not saying the Blazers are moving. I'm just saying, is she trying to, like, create no parking when she goes to the game? Like, there's no traffic? You know, like, what is Jody Allen trying to do? Just, it feels a little similar in a weird way.
I hear what you're saying.
Just throwing that out there.
Probably as somebody who grew up here, I react to that in a way like, no, it's not the same. No, it couldn't be.
Well,
I'm probably skewed.
I was there in Seattle when right after Clay Bennett bought the Sonics and his group bought the Sonics, and he was, you know, obviously he was from Oklahoma City,
right?
And he bought the Sonics with his group, and then I happened to be in the arena because I believe the Blazers were playing the Sonics that very night
when he
came to his first game as the owner, and he addressed. I was in the arena, and Clay Bennett was standing there, and he was talking to kind of the ushers and the concession people, and he had him in a, like, sitting in a section.
Yeah.
And he was just kind of speaking to him, like, you know, we're going to do a good job. We're going to do right by you. You know, he was saying all this stuff. And I was like, yeah, and they're out of here. And they were. And they ended up, you know, moving to Oklahoma City. But what did they eventually did is they put the city of Seattle in a position where they knew the city of Seattle wouldn't build them a new arena.
Right.
And the NBA and the other owners went, well, I guess you have to leave. I'm not saying the Blazers would leave. They just have negotiated this bridge lease extension that bridges them 5 more years into the future. It looks like they're trying to make improvements to Moda Center. But I'm just saying there's some undertones here that are a little troubling, to say the least. My lips are chapped. I need some balm. Maybe I'll go to the Blazers game and get it for $3, because that's what it costs to enter a Blazers game these days.
Where would the Blazers play their temporary home games? Down in Eugene? Matthew Knight Arena?
Go to Gill Coliseum. Do it there. Bonnie Jill Laughlin is coming up. Bonnie Jill Laughlin is coming up. She's an author. She's written a book about women who are successful on the court and in sports. You're going to want to be here. She's an NBA scout, a former Dallas Cowboy cheerleader, and an author. Bonnie Jill Laughlin, next. Hey.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Radio brought to you by Jamba, your local Jamba. Life is better blended. I want to thank Jamba, Steve, and the team there for their support of this radio show, their support of college athletes in the state of Oregon. And you'll be hearing all about Jamba and all the way up to college football season and beyond as we do interviews on this show. We'll be visiting in a few minutes with Bonnie Jill Laughlin, who is a sports broadcaster, a TV personality, an author. She became an NBA scout. She is the first woman to dance at the professional level for 3 different teams in 2 different professional sports. She was a Golden State Warriors dancer, a San Francisco 49ers dancer or cheerleader, member of the Gold Rush there, and a Dallas Cowboy cheerleader. She's now written a book, and the book is out, and it has kind of an interesting, it's an interesting time, and it's a good time, like great timing, to write a book about that celebrates women and female firsts in sports. And we're talking about Billie Jean King, Danica Patrick, Jackie Joyner Kersee, Layla Ali, Mary Lou Retton. Man, I grew up watching that Olympics. I was a kid. But watching that Olympics when Mary Lou Retton captured America. Now I'm watching Caitlin Clark, and I've got 3 daughters. They are jazzed about watching the Women's Final Four, which we're carrying on this station. Tomorrow we'll have the Women's Final Four games. Here's Caitlin Clark talking about the interest in the women's tournament.
I don't know. There's been like a lot of little moments, I think. I think just the crowds at our games, but also just like the people screaming and like wanting our autographs. Like people just scream my name constantly. And I think that's something that really never gets old or something you never take for granted. I think even like when you're out and about, like doing your own things, living your personal life, the people that come up to you and like really support your team and understand the game, I think that's the coolest thing. But I think also just in general, like the excitement around this tournament, like it's super cool. Like people are more excited about the women's side than the men's side, and I think that's obviously something that's really never been the case before, and it's cool to see how it's evolved. Like when I first started this when I was a freshman, like we couldn't even use the March Madness branding, and now to see this, and really it's just taken a whole nother level, and I expect it to continue to grow this year, and I think that's the coolest thing for myself.
Caitlin Clark, Iowa in action tomorrow as part of the Final Four. Our guest, Bonnie Jill Laughlin, trailblazer, really. NBA scout, dancer, model, actress, media member, author now. She's written a book. It's called In a League of Her Own, Celebrating Female First in Sports. Bonnie Jill Laughlin joining us. Bonnie Jill, how are you?
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
You bet. I got to start with your name. I'm going to guess, Bonnie Jill, what's the reason for 2 first names?
Well, most of my family is from the South, and I'm actually in Texas now. I moved back to Texas, but my dad wanted Bonnie, and my mom wanted Jill. They ended up doing Bonnie. Jill is my first name. Jill is not my middle name, because people always think it's a middle name, and it's funny because it's almost taken on my personality of having, where I've got, you know, my two split personalities, being like the tomboy and then also being like the feminine side of me. So it kind of shows the different layers of myself just like through my name.
I don't know anybody who's more qualified to talk about a variety of different sports than you. You've been around it your whole life. And, you know, I'm even told by our researchers that you do barrel racing. And so you've grown up kind of with that background. And I want to get into all of it. But the timing of this book, In a League of Her Own, is perfect. I mean, the book is out and you've got like this women's Final Four has just been nothing short of amazing.
Oh, it's been fantastic. And just like Caitlin said, just like Shaquille O'Neal said, this is the first time that I'm more into the women's basketball Final Four. I shouldn't say Final Four. The entire yeah. March Madness more than the men's. I mean, of course, you have your bracket, and of course you watch, but it really has taken its own life and showcased these women. And how many people would say that they'd ever think that they'd be watching the women's basketball over the men's? And I think that's the case for everyone. It's been so exciting. The only thing I wish is probably that you would have had LSU and Iowa and actually the national championship game. You know, that's a little disappointing, but still just to see that, you know, I'm excited to watch the game tomorrow with UConn and Iowa. And it's just been such a fun thing to watch. And like you said, the timing of my book has just been so perfect. It, you know, makes me think, yes, I do need to do a second book because I really would love Caitlin to be in my book as my chapter one, kind of like how Billie Jean King is my chapter one in my book now, because she has just really moved the needle. She's made such a big difference, and she really encompasses exactly what my why was and what I wanted to do when it, you know, came to women in sports.
What made you write the book? Was there a conversation you had or an interview you did, or has that been on your mind a while? What sort of drove that?
Yeah, John, there's been, you know, a long time where I've wanted to do a book, and so many times publishers asked me about doing a book, but they wanted to be a memoir and a tell-all about my time with the Lakers, my time with the Cowboys, and I was like, no, I'm not doing that. That's something where it's going to be gossipy and train wrecky, and they're like, yeah, we love that. I'm like, no, I want to do a book that's empowering and is, you know, inspiring, aspiring, and I just saw that there wasn't one book that had for younger women to see, a book that encompassed all the different females, not just a one-off of each girl, but actually showing that maybe not just as an athlete, a female athlete, Olympian, but also in a front office, a ref, a coach, you name it, owner, that there were so many layers of women in sports. And it wasn't just, you know, that one dimensional thinking how you could be there, and that there was a space for, you know, everyone. I wanted to resonate with the different ladies, and there wasn't a book that, you know, that professors and teachers could use to show that there was the trailblazers and pioneers who started it all.
What I think is cool is, you know, I have been in a lot of press boxes, and yeah, of course I've talked to scouts, and you've been an NBA scout, and I've talked to other media members, and you're a media member. But what I didn't expect is that, you know, if you look down at the sideline at a 49er game, there's the Gold Rush, and Bonnie Jill, you were a cheerleader for the 49ers and a Dallas Cowboys and a dancer for the Warriors. And my mind wouldn't have thought Gold Rush cheerleader writes this great book about Billie Jean King and Layla Ali, and that's shame on me, right? But we're at that time when you were cheerleading, were you thinking in these terms then, or is this something that came to you later?
No, I was that kid right out of the womb that didn't want the typical, you know, I wasn't looking at bridal magazines and wanting to get married, John. I was like, okay, what do I need to do to end up owning the Dallas Cowboys? You know what I mean? Like, I was so different, and my dad didn't understand, like, why is this little girl asking me about why do the guys get time to run the 40, you know, and why, you know, what college did he go to? And tell me about, you know, minor league ball. And so there was something that was different. I was reading the Sporting News, the Green, every single morning, you know, looking at that. I was handicapping horses because my dad owned racehorses, so I knew had a bet at like 5 years old. I was going and betting horses. So I was just different. You know, when you have a kid who's handicapping horses and looking at, you know, how to score a baseball game, I just was different. And I think that just the dancing was a way for me to get into the sports arena and have the best seats in the house. And I started, you know, with the Warriors and then went on to the Niners and Dallas Cowboys, but I was very young while I was going to college as well. But then, you know, obviously I was able to translate that into being in a front office and then in media, but it was always my goal to have a career in sports and to you know, be able to pivot, because as you know, it's like to have longevity, you can't just be one dimensional. I like to have different layers of myself. So whether it is being in the front office or being in the media, or, you know, and when you're in the media, being able to produce, be able to edit, be able to shoot, you know, whatever it may be, that I knew that I could do it all, because I think that makes you more valuable.
You're a Renaissance woman. I mean, you've done it all. And I got to ask you, NBA scout, what don't we know about life as an NBA scout?
No, it's not glamorous at all, because I think some people think, because I was fortunate enough to be with the Los Angeles Lakers and to be with the dynasty and be with them for 5 championship rings and get 5 rings, but being on the road in the middle of the night, landing in, I don't know where I'm at, renting a car and then driving at, you know, 2 a.m. trying to figure out where to find a certain arena, and being able to go all over the place and scouting. It wasn't glamorous. It was, especially in the beginning for me, it was really tough because I was trying to fit in and be one of the boys. So I would, you know, go into places and wearing the baggy Jordan sweats and throw my hair up in a ball cap, no makeup, you know, just so people would you know, perceive me differently. Oh, not that I was some cheerleader or model or whatever, but that I was taken seriously. And then B. Shaw, who was Brian Shaw, one of our coaches at the time, he's like, you know what? Phil Jackson has you doing this for a reason. You know, Mitch Kupchak, Jeannie Buss, the late Dr. Jerry Buss, just have confidence in the fact that you're knowledgeable. You know how to break down the triangle offense. You know, lead with that and stop worrying about people trying to accept you because you're a female. Or not accept you, I should say, rather.
What don't we know about life as an NBA dancer or an NFL cheerleader?
We get no money. I was a cheerleader for the Dallas Cowboys. I made $15 a game, and that
wow.
was taxed. So I think it was $13. We didn't get tickets, so we had to pay for our own tickets. Well, we all know you couldn't get a ticket for $13, even back in the 90s. So you were actually making no money. You wanted to buy tickets, you know, for the game as well. So that was really, you know, a stepping stone. And for me, I loved being able to perform, and you know, especially for the Dallas Cowboys, and, you know, I ended up becoming very close to the Jones family, who ended up being mentors for me going on and moving into different places. But networking and meeting so many people, I love dancing and cheering, but it wasn't something you could make a career out of, but it was something I definitely used to jumpstart my career in sports. And it was a great time in my life, but it was something I knew I needed to move on, because I wanted to be able to eat something more than just, you know, top ramen.
Right. In a League of Our Own is the book. Bonnie Jill Laughlin is the author. She's with us. Yeah, I mean, it's clear, it's evident. You use that networking, and good for you. There's a lot of kids that are that age, and I call you kids, but like when you're in your early 20s, you don't quite know how the world works, but you are around a lot of people who did. And so what gave you the confidence to sort of bridge those relationships with people like the Jones family and obviously the Lakers organization and others?
I think it was instilled in me at a young age. My parents, my mom had me write written notes. So when I'd meet people, I'd write a written note. I still write written notes today and send it, because I knew that goes a long way. And remember people's birthdays, and just, you know, you just develop those relationships, and you start to realize that, you know, you obviously have to have the talent and be able to have that work ethic, but you also, it does help when you have people that are in your corner and that can help you get to the next level and believe in you. And like for the Lakers, when I worked for the Lakers that first year, you know, I was basically an intern. I didn't get paid for that entire year. I was still working as media, you know, proved it that I could do it. And then I was able to sign a 5-year deal and a 5-year deal. So that work ethic was so important, but the relationships were just as important as well.
Did you ever sign a player who made it in the NBA?
Yeah, Jordan Farmar. I don't know if you remember Jordan.
Yeah.
Farmar, he was a... Okay, yeah, so...
UCLA
he
kid,
came
yeah.
from, yeah, then Taft High, which was Los Angeles as well. So he was a local boy and still usually like really big guards, you know, high basketball IQ. And he wasn't sure about Jordan, and, you know, I kind of kept pushing Jordan Farmar, and Jordan ended up playing for us and winning 2 championship rings. So it was nice to see, but it was tough because while I was scouting, we also had really late draft picks because we were winning, right? So yeah. We didn't get a lottery pick, or, you know, so it was tough, and still was very, very picky about who he liked. So there were guys that you may like, but if it was an undersized guard, you know, or a guard that's used to running a fast tempo offense, you wasn't going to like him. So like like if you look at a Luke Walton, you know, Luke would have probably not, Luke will kill me for saying this, but he probably wouldn't have made it as long as he did in the NBA, but because of the triangle, it was such a perfect offense for him, and D-Fish and so many of these guys that it really, that triangle works so well. I know a lot of organizations hate, you know, running it, but it really worked for a lot of players and these role players that end up, you know, with the five rings after that.
We're always looking at championship level teams and then maybe some teams that struggle. And you've been around winners and you've probably been around some teams that weren't that good. What do you see it as far as culture with winning organizations that, you know, if we're just talking about, hey, we're striving to add these ingredients because we want the franchise to be the best it can be. What things pop to your mind?
I think the first thing when you mention that is, you know, the greatness, you know, for the Lakers organization or the Dallas Cowboys, you had players that mediocrity was not an option. When you're looking at a Kobe Bryant and right after he won the championship against Boston or Orlando or New Jersey, he was in the gym the next day shooting jumpers. We just won, you know, and I'm going over to the facility and he's there, you know, and, you know, he kind of set a precedent, and that greatness, that work ethic is so important. And yeah, I don't think that's something that you end up working your way through. I think the work ethic is something that you're fiery, you're hungry for, you're kind of born with that, and it's hard to kind of make up that DNA of someone who wants to win even after you just won a championship. And I think the Lakers and the Cowboys and the 49ers, all the teams I was with, you know, it was always having those great people around, the Jerry Rices and the Troy Aikmans and, you know, Michael Irvin, Emmitt Smith. It's like they all were never happy with just winning one. They always wanted to win more, and that's hard to find. But it was having those type of players in that front office and the coaching staff that had that same mentality.
You know, it's not hard right now to look around and find women who are now working in prominent positions in the NFL, like Amy Trask and in Major League mm-hmm. Baseball. And clearly this Final Four this weekend is going to be a celebration of that. And what does that mean to you personally as a kid who grew up around sports, and now maybe there's a generation of kids coming along now who can look up and see people in those positions?
I love that, and that's why I wrote my book. And when I do these signings and I look through my messages on social media, I'm getting mothers and daughters and so many different women, you know, not just in the younger generation, but even, you know, older ladies who are saying, oh my gosh, I never knew that there was a space for me in sports. And you know, even at any age, and being able to have this book to show that there is a space for you. And if there isn't, you know, someone in that space, make it, create it, be that first person, you know. And so you see all the ladies, like you mentioned, Amy Trask and, you know, Mary Lou and Danica Patrick and Layla Ali and all the women that were the first that are in my book. And I wanted to highlight the ones that are the legends, but I also wanted the hidden gems like Manon Raume, who's the first female to play in an NHL hockey game, and Julie Crown, who's the first female to win a Breeders' Cup as a jockey. And there were just so many different women that I wanted to highlight that didn't have the social media when they were at the top of their game. Or Jackie Joyner Kersee, there's a younger generation who definitely doesn't know who she is. And so it was really important for me to have a book where it was obviously the legends, but also the women that are the first that you didn't know about.
I think it's great that you've written the book. It's perfect timing. Did you see this coming, or did you just say, I'm writing it, and then as the college basketball season's unfolding, you go, oh my gosh, this is going to be great?
Yeah, it worked out perfect. Like I said, it took almost 3 years to get a publisher to sign on because they wanted to have the tell-all book that I wouldn't do. And so finally, Roman Littlefield, the publisher, said, yes, we love this. We understand your why. And then it's, you know, I had 9 months to write it, and it was really tough to try to figure out everyone that I wanted to put in my book. And now looking, you know, of course, Caitlin Clark, you know, Katie Ledecky, who will probably, you know, be amazing in the Olympics. Everyone talks about Michael Phelps. Well, Katie Ledecky, she blows him out of the water, literally, when it comes to how many gold medals she has. So there's so many women that are, you know, just starting to people to understand what they've done, and they've been doing it for so long. So my timing was perfect, and it's nice to see that they're both men and women are on board with women in sports, because it's tough. You know, there's a lot of scrutiny when you're a female in sports in any capacity, and you're having to work harder and prove yourself, and there's no room for error when you're a woman in sports. So that people don't realize the pressure that is on women. And so I think it's starting to come shed some light right now.
I think for you in particular, though, because you know, in your early life are a dancer for the Warriors, you're Gold Rush, you're Dallas Cowboy cheerleader, you're in magazines, you're on the cover, you're on Baywatch, right? You're on Baywatch, is that right?
Yeah, back okay. in the day, yep.
Okay, so you're on all this stuff, and then, you know, you have to walk in there and you want to be taken seriously, and I think mm-hmm. you walk in, all that other stuff walks in the room with you.
Oh, absolutely. That was on my back, you know, all the time. She just stopped cheering and then went right into scouting. And it's like, no, I was working at it for a while. But there was, you know, a lot of that stereotype, you know, and stereotypes are in place for a reason, right? So I really had to prove myself that, yes, I still embrace where I came from. I wasn't hiding any of that. You know, there's still to this day, you see, I don't hide any of that. I show that, you know, you can be an attractive female and also be knowledgeable and credible. And it does take a little longer sometimes, but I didn't, you know, make any shortcuts. And I was just, you know, authentic to who I was, but also was able to prove myself. And, you know, I've been, you know, in this industry for a long time now, and I've shown that there's a lot of sacrifices. And I think with me and Kobe Bryant, he was a mentor to me, and Kobe said, like, when someone had wrote a hit piece on me in the Boston Globe about me being a scout, he was like, this is good. You want naysayers. You want haters. He's like, it's good because it'll fuel you. And it did. And to this day, it's like, oh, you know, bring it on. You say I can't do this, I will prove you wrong. And so that's, I think, how I've gone through my whole career.
I love it. Bonnie Jill Laughlin, In a League of Her Own is the book. You can get it on Amazon, your local book retailer. It really does celebrate all of the female firsts in sports. All right, before I let you go, why not do the tell-all book? There's certainly going to be a big advance there. They're going to want the dirt on the Cowboys, Michael Irvin. They're going to want you to talk about the Lakers and what that locker room was like and what life as a cheerleader was like. And why not do the tell-all book?
I can name it in just one word, integrity. I don't think you'd offer me millions of dollars, which I've gotten pretty close to how much they've offered me to do something like that. A lot of those guys are my friends. I just would never do something like that again. I don't think that, of course, yeah, it's going to be a bestseller and be, you know, make a ton of money, but that's not why I do things. I do things to make a difference and to, you know, like I said, to inspire and to empower, and that's not going to empower anyone.
I grew up around some farmers and cowboys and the barrel racers, some of the toughest people that you can meet. Are you still barrel racing?
I am. It's funny you say that. I grew up on a horse ranch, and my dad had race horses, and then I was a barrel racer, and actually I'm working for the Cowgirl Channel covering rodeo the past year, and you know, breakaway and barrel racing, and I've got my little mare, my quarter horse mare Palomino, that I run barrels on, and that's a, as you said, cowgirls, you know, we're not scared of anything. And, you know, you just jump on a horse and you go, and you go fast and you turn fast. And it's a big adrenaline for me getting on my mare and doing that.
Bonnie Jill Laughlin, I appreciate you. Thanks for giving us some of your time. Wish you the best. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
You bet. There she goes. In a League of Her Own is the name of the book. You can check it out. I'm looking at it on Amazon right now. It's very early. It's just out. It's got 13 ratings, 5 stars. Bonnie Jill Laughlin's done a nice job with the book. Leave it here.
Back to the Bald-Faced Truth with John Canzano on 750 The Game.
Well, I wrote today at johnconzano.com about the newfangled idea in college football, the new proposal that's out. College Sports Tomorrow went public yesterday with a plan that I guess aims to replace the NCAA and the college football playoff. Now, you've probably read about it, but I'll just give you the cliff notes. 70 top programs, all members of the 5 former major conferences, plus Notre Dame and SMU, then that would be seven 10-team divisions there. The eighth division would be teams that are promoted from the second tier, the next 50 schools. So the group of fives that finish in the top 10 of the group of five get promoted to play in major college football. Now, I'm intrigued by the concept. I think there's a reckoning coming for major college athletics. I think it's going to be the lawsuits, not NIL, not the athletes asking to be employees. I think it's going to be the lawsuits that brings all of college athletics down like a house of cards. So the lawsuits that the class action house versus the NCAA, among others, there are a line of lawsuits that I think are going to be a devastating blow to the ecosystem. Now, I've floated out what I think about this, but I asked Kirk Schultz, the president at Washington State today, what he thought of it. He said he has not had a chance to really digest it. He was still digesting it, but he did say this, quote, "We do need to have some of these conversations, and I'm glad to see these ideas out in the open. Presently, if the Big Ten and SEC do not support something, not sure how it happens," end quote. It's an interesting comment because I have been told by multiple sources that the reason why the College Sports Tomorrow idea was floated out the way it was because the Big Ten and the SEC hurried to get the college football playoff TV deal done because they wanted it done in front of College Sports Tomorrow having their plan out there. So there was kind of a race that was going on with the 20 or so individuals that are behind College Sports Tomorrow trying to get meetings with the Big Ten, the SEC, the Big 12, and the ACC. They did sit down with the ACC, but they were trying to get these meetings. Meanwhile, the Big Ten and the SEC were going, "We don't want to have this conversation. It's disrespectful to our TV partners. And oh, by the way, we want a March 15th deadline to get this damn college football playoff extension done." And they were very focused on getting that done by March 15th. Why? Because they didn't want ambiguity in the space while private equity firms and College Sports Tomorrow was pushing forth this newfangled idea. And so, you know, here's the dirty little secret. Like, I do think football eventually splits away. I think it's going to take time, though. I'm not convinced 80 teams is going to work. Bob Thompson, the retired Fox Sports Networks president, said on social media, way too many. He said top 48 teams would generate as much TV revenue as the top 80 because you'd have better matchups. So yeah, it's probably not going to be top 70, top 80. It'll be a smaller group. But I do think the lawsuits are going to bring it down. And I do think it happens on a timeline that's consistent with the SEC and the Big Ten's media contracts. Keep in mind, they start expiring around 2030. So that's the timeline. We'll talk more about this on tomorrow's show. I'm excited that we're carrying the final four games right here on 750 The Game. The women's final four semifinals tomorrow right here on 750 The Game. The bald-faced truth, not here for a long time, just a good time.